Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science and department chair at Drake University, joining us by phone this hour. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm very well. I hope your driveway is shoveled and you're
for the moment.
For
that's
the
moment. That's only temporary in Iowa this winter.
Until the next round. Rachel Caulfield, I think you made it into our studio in Des Moines. Welcome to you.
Hi there.
Do you have some snow shoveling behind you this morning?
I have a lot of snow shoveling behind me this morning.
All right. Professor of Political Science at Drake University as well. Rachel and Dennis, so glad to have you with us this hour. And we want to reach out to our listeners later in the hour to join our conversation. Later in the hour, updates on the Russia investigations and also the national emergency declared on the weekend. I guess that was last week, by the president and sort of the repercussions of that. This first half hour, though, we want to talk about the 2020 Democratic candidates, now a growing field. I think about a dozen have either formed exploratory committees or have officially declared their intentions. Bernie Sanders from Vermont has now officially entered the 2020 race for the Democratic presidential nomination. We want to reach out to you listeners. Do you support Bernie Sanders in 2016? Did you support him? Did you support him in 2016? Will you support him again in 2020 is what I wanted to say. And also, Democrats, what qualities are you looking for in a presidential candidate? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, river2river, at iowapublicradio.org, or tweet Iowa Public Radio. Well, Bernie Sanders, in fact, an independent who caucuses with the Democrats in the Senate. That was a point of contention, that he's an independent, actually, but running for the nomination, even though not an official member of the party. Now, a dozen or so candidates who've either officially announced or formed exploratory committees. Let's listen to a little bit of Bernie Sanders to get our sense of him. Back to Bernie Sanders. This is this week announcing his presidential bid in a campaign video.
We are the wealthiest nation in the history of the world. We should not have a grotesque level of wealth inequality in which 3 billionaires now own more wealth than the bottom half of the country. We should not have 30 million Americans without any health insurance, even more who are underinsured, and a nation in which life expectancy is actually in decline. We should not have an economy in which tens of millions of workers earn starvation wages and half of older workers have no savings as they face retirement. We should not have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth.
Dennis Goldford, what does Bernie Sanders' official announcement mean for the field?
Well, what we heard are Bernie's greatest hits. In other words, they're the kinds of themes he was articulating in 2016. Now, you could argue that he needs to articulate them this year because the problems he's concerned about have not been addressed. That's a legitimate argument. The difficulty for Senator Sanders is that there are all sorts of folks in the Democratic field, actually or potentially at this point, who are saying pretty much the same thing or something very similar to that. So whereas he had that more progressive wing or lane, I should say, as we used that terminology last time around, that lane's a bit more crowded this time.
So we're going to put in that lane Elizabeth Warren for sure, right?
Sure. Elizabeth Warren says things like that. We saw Amy Klobuchar try to distinguish herself, for example, in that regard. One of the difficulties for all these candidates, and as you said, we have about a dozen with exploratory committees or actually having announced, plus maybe 10 more or so who are thinking about it, they've got to distinguish themselves from their fellow candidates while at the same time not alienating those candidates and especially their potential supporters, because you're going to need everybody to defeat an incumbent president.
Rachel, Bernie Sanders, certainly a disruptive candidate in the Democratic process there the last time. Do you see him to be the disruptor this time as well?
Well, I think in many ways, Bernie Sanders is a victim of his own success. He jumped into that race in 2016, I think, to set the agenda, to raise issues that nobody in the party was really talking about. And he succeeded and, you know, kind of demonstrated that the left wing of the Democratic coalition was alive and well. And at this point, many of those ideas have been taken up and have become much more central to the platform and the candidates of the Democratic Party circa 2020. And so, you know, in that sense, Dennis is absolutely right. Just simply distinguishing himself at this point, he is no longer disruptive in the way that he was. So finding a way to say, look, you know, this is a party that cares deeply about identity and about advancing diversity and inclusion within the country. I'm an older white man, but I started talking about these things before everybody else, so I should get it. That seems, I think, to be a difficult case to make. It's and you saw some early suggestions of that even in 2016, where, you know, we heard about concerns that his campaign really didn't have the capacity to reach out to a lot of different kinds of voters, particularly minority voters within the party.
Right. Nevertheless, here in Iowa, coming with a within a quarter of a percentage point of Hillary Clinton, just by a whisker, Hillary Clinton winning the Iowa caucuses here. Dennis, you mentioned Bernie's greatest hits. This is something I don't think we heard in 2016. Of course, then his opposition was Hillary Clinton. Had he achieved the nomination, it would have been the president-to-be. But here's Bernie Sanders on Vermont Public Radio earlier this week. Not his best hits. He is describing here the current occupant of the White House.
I think the current occupant of the White House is an embarrassment to our country. I think he is a pathological liar every day. He is telling one lie or another. And it gives me no pleasure to say that. But I also think he is a racist, a sexist, a homophobe, a xenophobe, somebody who is gaining cheap political points by trying to pick on minorities, often undocumented immigrants.
Okay, one thing Democrats agree on, Dennis, is they want to beat Donald Trump. Does Bernie have the right recipe here?
That's the question. You've got to have a positive message. You can't say simply, I'm not Trump. The fact that we have perhaps close to two dozen actual or potential Democrats running for the nomination shows or indicates that there are a lot of Democrats who believe that President Trump is indeed vulnerable, but it's early yet. It's always tough to defeat an incumbent president. But simply saying, I'm not him, is not sufficient. It's for any campaign. It's not going to work. Now, the biggest difficulty for the Democrats is, I think, and we already see Republicans starting to use this approach, is that if they're not careful with the way they talk and the terms they use, you know, Republicans are already trying to paint all of them, and this certainly applied to Senator Sanders in 2016 and now, as radical, out-of-touch socialists. And if there is any word in the American political vocabulary or American culture that Americans are uncomfortable with, even if they're younger ones, although their younger ones are more comfortable with it, but still, in terms of the great mass of voters, that term socialism has always been a scare word in American political culture. Maybe it's declining as a scare word, but it's always been a scare word, and Republicans will use that against not just Senator Sanders, but all the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, conventional wisdom was used against Donald Trump, though, and isn't he a case in point where conventional wisdom can just be blown out of the water? And you talk to a Democratic socialist and they say the groundswell is there. You just have to tap it.
I always love that we get to use Donald Trump as an example that conventional wisdom just simply doesn't work anymore.
Do you think is that a fair comment or not?
Well, clearly he tapped into something and very few people saw it coming.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think I said even during the 2016 election, I think there is a similarity in style between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in that both have the authenticity factor, right? And that's really what caught fire for Bernie Sanders in 2016 and how he was able to differentiate himself so clearly from Hillary Clinton, not only on issues, but on style, personality, presentation. And there are a lot of people out there who are really craving that authenticity, that sense of honesty, the lack of polish. I think, you know, there's something there that he brought to the race in 2016. Whether or not he can catch fire again with that, I think, is a big question.
Mm-hmm. On Monday in California, let's talk about Elizabeth Warren a little bit. She just entered a week or so ago, officially announcing at an organizing event for her campaign in California on Monday. She unveiled her plan for universal child care for every child in the U.S. under the age of six. She said the proposal would be paid for by a, quote, ultra-millionaire tax that would apply to families with a net worth of over $50 million. Here's a bit of her.
Right now, in 28 states in America, child care for a little kid costs more than tuition at the state university. Think about that. And the consequence is families are just buckling under the weight of it. It holds people back. They decide that they can't work because they are worried about the cost of child care. It also means there are a lot of kids who don't get into good child care, and that we're not making the investments in early learning, in our littlest ones. So that's why I put together a proposal that's for 0 to 5, everybody under 6 years old, and it makes a guarantee. And the guarantee is about what each of our children is entitled to, not just the children of the wealthy, not just the children of the well-connected, but every one of our children.
Okay, Elizabeth Warren on Monday. We're getting a lot of these candidates, Dennis and Rachel, talking about tax hikes for the ultra-rich in this case. Dennis, when was the last time a presidential candidate ran on raising taxes and won?
Well, your second part of the question is the killer, of course, because you recall that in 1984, Walter Mondale, at one of the debates with President Reagan, said, I'm going to tell you the truth. I will raise your taxes, and so will he, but I'm telling you, and he won't. And he lost, what, 49 states, something like that?
I was going to say, it went really well for him.
It went really well for him, right. See, the problem for Democrats is that, as opposed to Republicans, who tend to be very good at messaging in the sense of an overarching theme or umbrella under which you can fit various policy prescriptions like Make America Great Again, the Democrats typically give you a laundry list of specific policies. Now, that's not to say that if you're a Democrat or considering voting for a Democratic nominee that that particular policy issue isn't important to you or that it's not worthwhile. That's not to suggest that. But, at times when we tried to figure out in 2016 what Hillary Clinton was arguing, the response was essentially, go read my website. But you can't put that on a bumper sticker. And I'm not saying all political discourse should be bumper sticker level, but you need a way of enveloping thematically what it is your candidacy means and stands for, why you're going to improve the lives of the people whose votes you're seeking. And Democrats still give us this laundry list, which I think is part of their difficulty.
Mm-hmm. But, Rachel, let me ask you, by targeting the ultra rich, is there a risk for the Democrats there? I mean, if you're not affected by a tax cut that's being proposed, if you're not in this ultra-rich 0.5% category, do you have to worry? Does it change your vote?
Well, so one of the animating features of American life has always been that even as we resent the rich, we don't want to create policies that tax the rich because we all think one day we might be rich. So
that's a good way of putting it.
There's kind of a structural element there to the American dream mythology that we use so often. I do think Elizabeth Warren probably more so than some other candidates, Elizabeth Warren has been working on these basic ideas for her entire career. If anyone is able to kind of come up with a grand thematic way of talking about them, I think she's likely to be the candidate who can do that. Having said that, I think Republicans, as Dennis said, are very good at kind of crafting a message that resonates with a lot of Americans. And one of the messages that we've seen from Republicans over the past few cycles is this idea that Democrats are kind of fostering a sense of class warfare, right? That it's the rich against everybody else and that that's not good for the country. And I think she's potentially open to those critiques. And I think she knows it. And I think she, in some ways, welcomes it.
Rachel Caulfield is with us, as well as Dennis Goldford, two political scientists from Drake University. Join our discussion, especially if you're a Democrat and plan on participating in the Democratic caucuses in just under a year. Did you support Bernie Sanders in 2016? Will you support him again in this new landscape? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Brian is joining us from Clinton. Hi, Clinton. Hi, Brian in Clinton. Did either of the questions get an answer for you?
Excuse me?
Brian, will you be supporting Bernie Sanders? Did you in 2016?
I did. I did some door knocking and some phone calling for him. I campaigned for him in 2016, but this time around I'm going with Tulsi Gabbard.
Why Tulsi Gabbard? She's the senator from Hawaii.
She's a veteran. She has the experience, the world experience that a president needs.
Okay. Brian and Clinton, thank you very much. Thoughts, Rachel, Dennis, on Tulsi Gabbard?
I think Brian's reasoning is really interesting, in part because, you know, one of the things Democrats are always accused of is really not giving nearly enough attention to military policy and foreign policy more generally. And so that's certainly something that's a critique that Bernie is open to.
Okay. Let's listen to another candidate. After a trip through Iowa, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota took questions at a CNN town hall in New Hampshire, this audio from Monday of this week. Here's her response to what she would ask President Trump if she had the chance to ask him one question during a debate.
My question would be, does he pledge to obey the law? Because to me, that has been one of the biggest problems with this president, is that he keeps undermining the law in this country. He keeps undermining his own attorney general, the former attorney general. He keeps undermining the Mueller investigation, which is a major investigation focused on a foreign country trying to intervene in our election. And that, to me, while there are so many things I would love to ask him, and I'm sure we'd love to ask him a number of things about what he's done and why he's done them and why he isn't consistent in his foreign policy, I think this fundamental question and pushing him on his view of the law is important.
Okay, Amy Klobuchar there, running against the party that likes to think of itself as the traditional party of law and order. Does that work, Rachel, for you?
Well, I mean, I think Amy Klobuchar is a really interesting candidate, not only in how she's positioning herself here relative to the president, which kind of foreshadows, I think, the way a lot of people think of her in a general election context. And I think she did a good job with that particular question. But, to Dennis's point about all the different lanes that different candidates are trying to identify, Amy Klobuchar really right now has a lane to herself, which is kind of running as this moderate who can reach out to middle American, perhaps Trump voters, and those who really aren't, looking for more extreme progressive policies,
right,
or some sort
said,
of economic
right.
revolution.
Unlike some, she has said no to Medicare for all, right?
Yeah.
And no to free college.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she has the lane all to herself.
Right now she does. Yeah, we'll see where this goes.
Popping up in her lane if he decides, the big dog in the room,
that's
Joe,
right.
Joe Biden, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Dennis, your thoughts on Amy Klobuchar?
Well, I agree. She is trying to create a more centrist image. I mean, the question right now is, as Democrats try to react to the Trump phenomenon, are they reacting by becoming even more liberal or progressive? Are the Democrats going to become the party of a representative, Ocasio-Cortez, who gets a lot of press? She's attractive, photogenic, extremely young, not even young enough to run for Senate, let alone president, I believe. And is that going to be the Democratic Party? That may well attract quite a number of people, but that's going to put off quite a number of people who might be inclined to vote for the Democrats. Or is the party going to say, look, in, at least in the view of the Democrats, the Republicans have abandoned any kind of place in the center, center-left, center-right, dead center, as they've become a wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump Organization. So are the Democrats going to try to claim that vacated space in the middle, more or less, or are they going to believe that there is no such middle anymore and our job is to activate that that more progressive side on the other side from the Republicans, and in the belief that they have more people potentially there than the Republicans on the Trump side do.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just note, these are two fundamentally different campaign strategies as well, mm-hmm. right? For those who are advocating kind of a return to the center, a claiming of that middle ground, this is a persuasive effort, right? It's about going out and talking to the middle of the road voter in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Iowa, and potentially switching enough votes that they can win an electoral college victory. For those who are looking at the more progressive end of the party, it's a fundamentally different campaign strategy in that it's not about addressing any of those voters in those kind of Midwest swing states like Iowa. It's really about drumming up new voters, getting minority voters registered and out to vote, getting young people registered and out to vote. It's about attracting kind of a new vanguard of participation among populations that have previously not been known for regular participation.
Before we go to break, let's squeeze in Adam calling from Des Moines. Not much time. Adam, you've got a question. Welcome.
Thank you. I more so kind of believe in Bernie just for the fact that he can take on the big banks, you know, and eliminate that influence that they have, you know, and get us back to more of an actual democracy rather than a corporate controlled, you know, system, you know, and his attack on the pharmaceutical companies too. You know, there's a lot of influence there that needs to be gotten out of actual politics to get back to actually something where we're actually representative. You know, represented by our politicians rather than, you know, them representing the needs of these big banks and corporations. You know, the fact that we have that, you know, people are spending millions, almost and billions on winning an office that is, you know, $400,000, $500,000 a year job, it just doesn't make sense. You know, the control that money has over our, you know, society alone is too much.
Okay. Adam, very quickly, in a couple words, do you think Bernie will have inspired the passion that he did among many in 2016?
Yeah, you know, I saw a lot of new people coming out. You know, you could see a division in the room from the age of the people supporting Bernie to the age of the people supporting Hillary.
What about, will that hold true for 2020, though?
I think so. I think it was a big change in the fact that a lot of younger people are getting involved now.
Okay. Adam in Des Moines, thanks for your input. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Join our conversation as we continue a little bit into the second half hour to discuss the 2020 candidates, now about a dozen of them, with Rachel Caulfield and Dennis Goldford of Drake University. We'll be back in just a moment. Also talking about the latest in the Russia investigations and the national emergency that was declared by the president. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition with Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, two political science professors there. Our political science is picking apart the 2020 candidates, about a dozen of them so far, exploratory committees or officially declaring their intention to run for that spot, the nomination in the Democratic Party, including within the most recent days, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, actually an independent. And we know the big splash, surprising splash that he made in 2016, also here in Iowa, coming within a whisker of beating Hillary Clinton, the favorite in the 2016 Iowa caucuses. Getting emails from some of our listeners. Doug writes, I'm a Vietnam vet and an independent voter who supported and campaigned for Bernie Sanders in 2016. It is too early to decide who I'll caucus and vote for next year. I would support Joe Biden if he ran, but right now I'm leaning toward Kamala Harris. An email from Ben, another Ben, obviously. I would like to see the primary process change in Iowa for one reason. Second shift workers are not able to participate. I would like to see the system changed to a ranked choice voting process. A couple of interesting things and opening there to talk a little bit about process. Our emailer, Ben, might not know. We've done a little bit on this program about the caucus system changing, at least the Democrats exploring the idea of virtual caucusing. Dennis, Rachel, either of you know about that, so because that is the chief criticism, right?
It's hard to know a lot about it yet until we see more detail on how it'll actually work. But Rachel, go ahead and I'll follow you.
Well, the Democratic Party announced that pursuant to changes by the Democratic National Committee rules, the Iowa Democratic Party will be creating some new options for caucusing in the 2020 cycle, including virtual caucuses that will take place over a period of time in, I believe, January, in late January, that will allow participants to basically conference in. We're uncertain exactly how they will conference in, but they'll be able to register in advance and then conference in to participate and have their preferences recorded that way if they're unable to attend on the night of the precinct caucuses.
Right. Another process question. What about superdelegates? There was huge controversy over that. Superdelegates, I think, all going for Hillary Clinton last time. Dennis, has that been changed?
They've been eliminated, I believe.
Again.
Yes.
It doesn't sound like you're so sure they will stay away.
Well, you know, they arose after the McGovern campaign in 71, 72, when you had all these folks start to participate and had started to use primaries as the primary way of amassing delegates for a presidential nomination instead of a state senator or governor going with those state delegates in his or her pocket to the national convention and spending them as he or she thought most wisely. By 1980 or so, or after the Reagan landslide, I think a lot of Democrats thought, well, you know, it's nice we have all these people showing up who've never done this before, but we need to have some place for some people with a little experience in how all these things work and experience with policies and issues. This was not dissimilar to the argument as to why there should be an electoral college, by the way, in the 1780s. But in any case, it's around, I believe, Rachel, wasn't it 84, I think, that they first put the superdelegates back in?
Yeah.
And, of course, that came to be the complaint on the part of the Sanders people last time around.
Interesting. And in another way, you could criticize it, Dennis, what you just explained is we need a back room with cigars filled with smoke.
We need a little bit of backroom action.
A little,
You
need people who want to say in terms of the exuberance of people, okay, stop for a minute. Are you sure you really want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
You need at least not that, not the sense. Sure, I mean, one of the arguments after the Chicago Convention in 1968 was, yeah, you had all these smoke-filled back rooms determining everything, and outside where the real passion was in the streets of Chicago and elsewhere, civil rights, Vietnam, and so forth, young people, women, and minorities weren't heard. It's a lot more easy, at least on the Democratic side now, for those folks to be heard, whether or not we have superdelegates at the moment.
Okay, let's get to our phones once again. Eric is calling from Des Moines and listening there. Hi, Eric. Thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi there.
Hi.
First of all, I wanted to say hi to Professor Rachel Payne Collier. I was a former student of hers, and I always enjoy listening to you guys on the radio. Hi, RPC.
Hi.
My question isn't necessarily on the topic that you were just recently talking about with the Iowa caucuses and the superdelegates, but my issue is more so wanting to talk about the media and its influence in politics, and specifically the more leftward-leaning bent of the mainstream media. And I think 2019 has really demonstrated to the American public the hand that the mainstream media is trying to play. Specifically looking at three issues, or not issues, but the BuzzFeed report that was reported earlier in 2019. It was aired on NPR, where it was supposed that an indictment was coming down the pipe. A second one was the Covington Catholic story. A third one most recently is the Jesse Smollett story, where the mainstream media is really pushing a narrative without waiting for full facts to come out. I wanted to hear your opinion on that and the potential benefits that offers to President Trump in that the media is really throwing a lot of support behind mainstream Democratic candidates.
Okay, interesting, Eric. And in that vein, Donald Trump tweeting today, the New York Times reporting is false. They are a, in all caps, they are a true enemy of the people. That's a tweet from the president today.
Sir, that wasn't the question. You look at.
No, wait a minute. Eric, you were talking about the media. I was adding something. Let's get comment from Rachel and Dennis. I was throwing in another relevant media news from today. So Rachel, go ahead. I guess we address you as RPC now.
Yeah, my students all call me RPC. It's true. So I think on the whole, there are a lot of incentive structures that underlie the media and its coverage of politics. So, you know, part of this, I think, is a drive for eyeballs, right? Or earbuds or whatever it is. And the way you attract people to your whatever news outlet that it is, you know, and that's how you make money through advertising, of course, right? Is to be incendiary, provocative, controversial, right? And you need to be actually kind of on the news story first or immediately thereafter. So I think there's a great fear of taking the time to really digest facts of stories. Mm-hmm. And when you have a very polarized political environment with a lot of accusations going around very quickly, the incentive structure for most media organizations simply doesn't permit a lot of depth and nuance. And I think social media has exacerbated that by making news basically constant. And social media absolutely favors provocation and controversy. And so, you know, I think automatically attributing some of these concerns to an intentional ideological bias is perhaps a mistake, but I do think that there are pretty deep-seated issues that need to be addressed within a lot of America's newsrooms. And I would note, you know, programs like this one and other NPR programs, I think, that try to do a good job of actually taking time to digest and go through things. That's a different form of media coverage.
All right, Eric, we hope Rachel answered your question there, addressed it properly. let's hear one more candidate that has been in Iowa recently, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She met with Iowa Democrats across the state this past week. Here's a little bit of audio from her at a campaign event in Iowa City this past Monday night. Audio from the Iowa City Press Citizen.
And I will stand up for what's right. I will stand up to the banks and the huge corporations that make all the decisions in Washington. I voted against the bank bailout twice as a New Yorker. I will stand up to the Department of Defense when they don't believe that LGBTQ Americans should serve in the U.S. military. When President Trump tries to demonize transgender troops, I will stand up to him and say he is wrong and that is making us weaker, not stronger. And I will stand up to our own party if I need to.
Kirsten Gillibrand in Iowa City earlier this week. Dennis, give us your read on her. Of course, she's the only... is she the only candidate so far from the Midwest? So she's got that going for her in terms of the Iowa caucuses, right?
Gillibrand's from New York.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Sorry. I didn't do the switch from Klobuchar to Gillibrand. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, look, Klobuchar's Midwest, at least at the moment. But look what we have from New England. We've got Warren. We've got Sanders. We've got Gillibrand. Mm-hmm. We've got, if you count New Jersey up there, of course, Booker. So we've got a whole collection up there, even as population, of course, over the last 50 years has moved south and west. But, you know, I guess I'm in the position, without having the time to sit down and study websites and things like that yet, it's just Gillibrand sounds to me like a fairly generic Democrat at this point, hitting the right progressive notes. And I'm still waiting to find the thing that, again, to use the term I used earlier, distinguishes her from the others, and I'm just not hearing that yet. I'm just not hearing it yet.
Rachel, what do you think of Kirsten Gillibrand?
Well, I think one of the things right now that's distinguishing her from a number of her peers in the race is her support of and very open admiration for Hillary Clinton. And you know, there's a long relationship there. They serve together. And so, you know, as she lists the women who have been most important in shaping her her life and her career, Hillary Clinton's right at the top of that list. And I think there are a lot of Democrats right now who have kind of soured on the legacy of Hillary Clinton. I think Kirsten Gillibrand is looking to, yeah, to directly invoke that legacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Go ahead, Rachel. Sorry.
No,
I will note one thing about the Democratic field and what you said about Senator Gillibrand makes me think of it. That, you know, for quite a long time, I said, certainly with regard to the 2016 elections, that with the exception, say, of Trump, who was an outlier, and Jeb Bush, the Republicans had already gone through their generational shift. In other words, if you think of the gang of folks who ran for the Republican nomination last time around, you know, and they were in their 40s and 50s, more or less, with, I think, Jeb in his 60s at some point, and Trump older than that. And the Democrats really hadn't gone through or begun that generational shift to a great extent because so many of their up-and-coming people were swept out of office in the Republican landslides of 2010 and 2014. Now, with the exception of Joe Biden, wherever he's going to be on this case, and Bernie Sanders, you do have, for the first time, a significant number of younger, new generation Democrats, like Gillibrand and Kamala Harris and Gabbard and Castro and Booker and so forth. And so the question is, who will emerge as real leadership potential, as opposed to being simply a member of a cast of dozens?
And that generational shift in the Republican Party, I mean, when it took place largely around the Tea Party.
Right.
Right. And so in many ways, the Democrats are now having their Tea Party. I spent some time in Washington over January term with some students, and we talked to a lot of people, and one of them it will stick out to me for a long time. They call it the Herbal Tea Party. So the Democrats are going through their Herbal Tea Party, which has brought into the party a lot of new faces.
Let's check back in our phones as our hour winds down. Zach is with us in Moline. Zach, please be quick, but thank you for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to make a quick point. I could give you a million reasons on policy why Bernie Sanders is the only real choice for, you know, any positive change in America. But aside from policy, I just see him as the only candidate who's running for someone other than themselves. It just appears to me that, like, all the other candidates who have announced or are planning to announce are mostly just in it to promote their political brand and see and hear themselves on TV more than they normally would.
Okay, Zach and Moline, thank you very much. I guess that strikes right at the heart of what you said, you mentioned before, authenticity, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's something about Bernie Sanders.
The fate of the Democrats depends, among other things, on whether people like this caller were willing to vote for, in their view, second best last time or second best this time. And, you know, purists are the bane of every political party because they want 100% or nothing, and that's not the way our politics normally operate.
Mm-hmm. A couple of quick hits on other topics before we leave this Politics Wednesday. Of course, on the weekend, the president signed a bipartisan spending bill that included over $1 billion for the border wall that fell far short of the $5.7 billion he requested, declared a national emergency, his intention to free up $8 billion from a number of sources, including military construction cash, Department of Treasury, drug interdiction money at the Department of Defense. As of yesterday, at least four lawsuits challenging the president's authority to declare such a national emergency. Well, in Friday's speech in the Rose Garden, the president announced his plan and detailed it in an unusual way. The path he expected the emergency declaration to take through the court system. Listen to this.
The order is signed, and I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban. They sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division, and then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won.
Okay.
I loved this press conference, I have to tell you.
Rachel, your answer must be performed in upspeak, please.
Yeah, I'm going to avoid that.
So what do you think about the president's prediction here?
Well, he clearly recognizes that he's going to face legal challenges and that they're not all going to go his way. You know, the president, in addition to reaching out to his base on immigration, this is a message that reaches out to his base regarding the courts, right? And the need to retain Republican leadership so that they can continue to confirm judges. So it hits kind of multiple points for him in terms of his core base of supporters.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, did the president pull some victory out of this defeat on the wall?
He established with his base, I mean, going back to that base, and he wraps that base around him constantly because that's his whole security blanket, that protects him from possible opposition from his own party, let alone others in Congress and the country at large. So he changed the topic, and he said, look, because the narrative then was he got taken to the cleaners by Nancy Pelosi, and you don't hear about that anymore. You hear about him saying, well, I'm fighting for this, and I'm standing up to it. And for his base, that's why they elected him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you recall during 2016 and 2015, Jeb Bush, I believe it was, called him the chaos candidate. He's somebody who has little knowledge of and is no respecter of procedure and constitutional norms. And again, his base seems to like that. Those who oppose him believe that he's violating what it means to have a society and a country under law as opposed to arbitrary and capricious policy rulings. So, you know, to me, I keep going back, and Rachel, of course, you know this case, Youngstown, Sheet and Shue mm-hmm. versus Sawyer from the Korean War under President Truman, when Truman used kind of emergency powers to seize control of the steel mills for various reasons I won't go into, and the court said, sorry, you can't do that, you got to give them back. And so that will be a case at the heart of any kind of court litigation, providing the parties get standing to sue him.
Okay, last couple minutes here. Rachel, you've agreed to answer a trivia question of sorts from one of our listeners. This is interesting. Angie in Des Moines asks, in 2017, President Trump stated he didn't need his paycheck from office to which he would donate his paycheck to the Treasury or donate his salary. Did he do this? What is the current salary for the president? You looked into this. Thank you for doing that,
yeah.
Rachel.
So
what did you find out for Angie and the rest of us?
So the current salary for the president is $400,000. And the Constitution does require that the president take pay from the National Treasury. That was actually put in there. The founders really wanted to make sure that the president and all other federal office holders had a connection to the success of the National Treasury.
Mm.
And so the president's required to take a salary. So President Trump has revised his promise, and he takes $1 of that. Of that $400,000, mm-hmm. and the rest has been, in fact, donated to various arms of the government. So in the second quarter of 2018, he wrote a check for $100,000. It went to the Small Business Administration, and the Small Business Administration is using it for veterans entrepreneurship grants.
Mm-hmm.
I believe his first donation went to the National Park Service. So each quarter, he chooses some government program and directs that the money be given to that particular agency.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And of course, the Democrats in the House are looking, not perhaps knowing quite how to get a hold of Donald Trump's tax returns. Dennis, do you keep up on that? Or do you think it's likely someday the tax returns will be outed?
Depends upon how long we live, because that will be litigated and litigated and litigated. Evidently, Congress's investigatory powers do give particular committees
the authority to look into things like this. But, you know, the president will obviously fight that tooth and nail. And as with so many other things, it will go through the courts.
Do you see it any differently, Rachel?
No, I expect this is going to be a long-standing controversy. I don't envision any sort of silver bullet that's going to dramatically change the situation, and Trump's going to say, "Yeah, here you go." I do think over time it's going to be interesting post-presidency to see what sorts of information comes out about the Trump business and kind of any financial reportings regarding the various businesses that the Trump family owns and runs. For example, you know, we do have information on the amount of money that has been spent at Mar-a-Lago for purposes of Secret Service updates and things like that. So I expect some of that will begin to come out, but not full tax returns.
Rachel Caulfield, thank you for digging your way through the snow to get to the studio today in Des Moines. Professor of Political Science at Drake University.
It's an adventure.
Always on Politics Day. Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science, Department Chair at Drake University. Dennis and Rachel, thank you so much for joining us on this very snowy Iowa day with your version of politics.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.